Dr. Sandra Steingraber teaches at Cornell University. She's author of the book, Having Faith, An Ecologist's Journey to Motherhood. Welcome.
Hi, Steve.
I'm wondering if you could describe for me how the womb is an environment from an ecological point of view. I mean, what are we living in even before we're born?
Well, that was the thing that impressed me so much when I became pregnant at age 38. Here I was, this ecologist who had spent 20 years studying the interactions between animals and their habitat. And all of a sudden, I saw myself as a habitat. I imagined the interior of my uterus as a kind of inland ocean with a population of one. And so for me, the experience of pregnancy was a turning inward of turning my scientist's eye inward and researching myself. And it was a very exciting time.
Early on, you talk about the different things that make up the uterus. And of course, the amniotic fluid makes this interior ocean you refer to in your volume. I wonder if you could read a little from this section for us.
Sure, I'd be glad to. This section actually describes my own amniocentesis, and I had a kind of epiphany actually during this procedure when I actually got to hold the tube of my own amniotic fluid in my hands. And this scene opens when the obstetrician asks me to drink plenty of water. Drink plenty of water. Before it is baby pee, amniotic fluid is water. I drink water, and it becomes blood plasma, which suffuses the amniotic sac and surrounds the baby, who also drinks it. And what is it before that? Before it is drinking water, amniotic fluid is the creeks and rivers that fill reservoirs. It is the underground water that fills wells. And before it is creeks and rivers and groundwater, amniotic fluid is rain. When I hold in my hands a tube of my own amniotic fluid, I am holding a tube full of raindrops. Amniotic fluid is the juice of oranges that I had for breakfast, and the milk that I poured over my cereal, and the honey that I stirred into my tea. It is inside the green cells of spinach leaves and the damp flesh of apples. It is the yolk of an egg. When I look at amniotic fluid, I am looking at rain falling on orange groves. I am looking at melon fields, potatoes in wet earth, frost on pasture grasses. The blood of cows and chickens is in this tube. The nectar gathered by bees and hummingbirds is in this tube. Whatever is inside hummingbird eggs is also inside my womb. Whatever is in the world's water is here in my hands.
What do you mean by this?
I mean that women's bodies are the first environment for all of us. One of the things I learned about amniotic fluid when I actually researched it more closely is that amniotic fluid itself now, we know from some early studies coming out of Los Angeles, amniotic fluid itself is contaminated with the chemicals that we use in the industrial and agricultural worlds. We've detected PCBs in amniotic fluid now, dioxins and DDT. So whenever there is an exquisite communion between the internal environment of a pregnant woman's body and the external world, the placenta is an open doorway, not a sealed door on a space capsule. And if we contaminate the world's environment, we also contaminate the internal environment of a woman's body. And it really was that moment where I was able to hold a tube of my own amniotic fluid and realize that I myself was the water cycle now, that I decided I needed to write this book.
When we think of chemicals and the impact on pregnancy, thalidomide, the whole thalidomide scandal and scare mm-hmm. comes to mind. And it brings to mind the pictures of babies with flippers and other anomalies. What were your thoughts on this as you went through your own pregnancy, what chemicals might do?
Well, I realize it's not the typical activity, I suppose, for a pregnant woman to spend her first and second trimesters pouring through birth defect registry data and things like that. But that's indeed what I did. What I wanted to do during my pregnancy was explore how environmental threats come into this internal landscape of a pregnant woman's body and what kind of risks they actually pose, these earliest exposures to industrial and agricultural chemicals to the developing embryo and fetus. And I think the comparison with thalidomide is important because that was one of the first chemicals, and that one was a pharmaceutical, that we knew could come in during specific windows of vulnerability. And the message we learned from thalidomide, which really turns out now to be the message for all kinds of other chemical exposures, is that when it comes to fetuses and embryos, it's not so much the dose of poison that's important in determining harm. Equally important is the timing of exposure. And with thalidomide, this sedative that was given to pregnant women to help control morning sickness, if she took it on a particular day of her pregnancy, the baby might be born without legs. If she took it on another day, a few days earlier or later, it might be born without ears or without hands. And on another day, it would have a deformed uterus. And it really depended on which day she took the pills. And that lesson from thalidomide, which was so dramatic because the structural malformations it created were so obvious at birth. But what the new message now and the new science that's coming out on other kind of fetal toxicants is that when a child might be exposed to a particular kind of pesticide or a particular kind of industrial chemical on a certain day of exposure, you'll get a certain kind of effect, maybe a birth defect that's obvious at birth, but maybe, for example, it might affect the way the brain gets wired up. So when the baby's born, it looks fine, but perhaps in years to come, there may be some deficits in behavior or cognition or motor skills. So I'm thinking now of chemicals like methylmercury, which now contaminates our seafood, PCBs, which contaminate a lot of our food chain too. We know these chemicals can act as functional toxicants so that they affect our functioning rather than the way our organs and body parts are all put together.
The text of your book weaves together both your personal pregnancy and the facts and figures of pregnancy so that, you know, one page we're reading about your baby's first kick and then the next page we're learning about neural tube defects. Sandra Steingraber, how did you yourself experience pregnancy while at the same time learning about the possible pitfalls?
Well, I think every pregnant woman brings to bear on her experience of pregnancy all of her identities. And of course, one of mine is that of an ecologist. So I'm primed to think about neural tube defects and how perhaps the current way we practice agriculture is contributing to a prenatal problem. That's what I do in my professional life. But I also I discovered a couple of other parts of my identity into this pregnancy. One is that I am a cancer survivor, and the other is that I'm an adopted person. And I think what this meant for me, it made the experience of pregnancy maybe even more joyful for me than it might be for another kind of woman. I felt incredibly happy during most of my pregnancy. I think the adoptee piece of it is that I am barred by law from knowing my biological relatives. My own birth certificate is not available to me by law. And now I was going to give birth to my first blood relation. And this was amazing to me. I don't have that relationship in my life. And it because I can't look back to ancestors, I think the fact that I was carrying someone who carried my chromosomes was even maybe more amazing to me than it might be to someone else. Having had cancer meant for me that I was used to a lot of invasive medical procedures, so I could easily lie down and undergo an amniocentesis. I've undergone a lot worse procedures than that. And in fact, at one point I was getting an ultrasound on the same table where I had previously been scanned for signs of tumor. And now they were looking for growth again, only it was a good kind of growth, you know. So I had to lie there and laugh and tell myself, if they see something this time, it's good news, not bad news. And also the idea that my body could grow this new life was astonishing and impressive to me. And the idea I was now making this very long commitment, since parenthood does One likes to imagine a parenthood going on for at least a couple of decades. And this was so exciting for me to consider, since the message of and the experience of having cancer is to not look too far into the future and to take only one day at a time. It suddenly seemed like my horizons and my timeline was just expanding.
You write in your book that prenatal testing is a ring of fire one passes through in mid-pregnancy. Can you please explain that?
Well, for those of us who are a little older when we approach motherhood, and I had my daughter at 39, and I've just had my son now at 42, we're offered a plateful of different kinds of prenatal tests. The flagship one is the amniocentesis, in which about a shot glass full of amniotic fluid is removed by a syringe through the mother's uterus through the belly, and is subjected to chromosomal analysis. And what we're looking for when we do these things are rare defects. The chromosomes tell us about possible chromosomal problems like Down syndrome. There's a whole other set of syndromes they can look for. The fluid itself is actually also submitted for analysis, and this can tell us whether or not the baby has spina bifida. And of course, there are a lot of ultrasounds that go along with this. It turns out that amniocentesis is highly accurate in diagnosing very rare genetic problems with a child, but there's not a lot of context for the information. For example, we know a little bit about Down syndrome, but there are hundreds of other syndromes that this test can tell parents the baby has, and yet we can't tell a parent what this means for your child, what your child will be like based on this. Even with Down syndrome, we know there's a whole range of children that are more highly functioning. Some are more highly functioning than others. And so of what value is the knowledge? What very smart sociologist Barbara Rothman sometimes calls this incapacitating knowledge, the knowledge of rare chromosomal defects for which we can't say what it means for your child. On the other hand, there's ultrasound, either together with the amnio or separate. And this is a test in which we're actually looking at the baby, and so we have a kind of context, and yet it's often in error. So in contrast to the highly accurate but context-free amniocentesis results, an ultrasound can give you lots of context for an information but can be wrong, can see defects that are not really there, that are artifacts or just because of the way the baby's lying, or can miss certain defects. And so I think that together, the possibility that the information may not be correct, the possibility that the correct information may not tell you very much, creates this kind of anxiety, and we've routinized prenatal testing in mid-pregnancy, such that every woman, especially those over 35, kind of go through this right at the midpoint of their pregnancy and emerge on the other side with some kind of knowledge that they don't often quite know what to deal with. Now, what struck me during this whole process is not so much the anxiety of waiting for the medical results, because I've been through that before. I've waited for lab results through Christmas vacations, on summer holidays. You know, I've had a lot of different tests done, and I've had ambiguous results come back and have had to cope with that. But what struck me particularly about all these tests is we're hunting for rare genetic defects, and we're not spending equal time thinking about the way the world's environment is entering into the uterus, the molecules of food and water and air that are flowing through the woman's body, and these molecules are being rearranged and literally forming the body of this new child. We're not spending a lot of time thinking about the ways that environmental contamination may also create problems. Instead, we're just looking for these rare inherited things.
Can you give me a short list of environmental toxins which, through your research, you are the most concerned about?
I'm very worried about mercury. I think mercury is turning into a very similar story that lead was in the last century. And mercury rates are still rising now because, coal-burning power plants are the single most important source of putting mercury into the environment because mercury does contaminate coal reserves. And when this is burned, it goes into the atmosphere. We're mostly exposed not through breathing but by food because it works its way up the food chain into dangerous concentrations. And mercury, like lead, sabotages fetal brain development. It actually paralyzes the neurons as they're migrating and getting all connected up in the fetal brain. I'm worried about PCBs, which are another similar story to lead and mercury. PCBs are an industrial chemical once used in capacitors and other kinds of electrical equipment because it was so resistant to bursting into flames. Unfortunately, its inert qualities that it enjoys in the industrial sector, it does not enjoy in the body of a pregnant woman. Mercury interferes with thyroid hormone, and thyroid hormone is essential for helping guide the developing brain. And so when PCBs are present in a woman's uterus during pregnancy, thyroid hormone is flushed from the system, and all the wonderful projects it's supposed to oversee in the fetal brain are slowed down or don't happen when they're supposed to happen. And this, too, can lower IQ and cause problems in behavior later on for the child. So I think what has captured my interest now are the chemicals that have these invisible effects in the way that they sabotage certain kinds of cellular apparatus from getting set up correctly.
If suddenly a public policymaker gave you a magic wand and said, what's the one problem here for pregnant women and their children that they face that we could solve and would have the biggest impact, which would you pick?
I'm not sure that's an answerable question. I wish I could give a simple, dramatic answer, but a lot depends on local ecology. Again, it's a testimony to how there's this amazing interaction between the inner world of a pregnant woman and the outer world that she inhabits. For women who live in agricultural rural areas, we know we have good evidence that that pesticides are playing a role in determining the outcome of her pregnancy, whether it raises her risk for miscarriage, contributes to infertility, contributes to birth defects, or problems in the developing brain of the baby. All those things can play a role when pesticides are present in her environment. For women living in more industrialized areas, it may be the incinerator that she lives next to, which would be putting dioxins into the local air, the local environment. And we know that dioxins are a very powerful fetal poison. So I think the answer is a function of where the woman works, of where she lives, where her air, food, and water is coming from.
At one point you asked the question, why isn't there any public conversation on environmental threats to pregnancy?
Mm-hmm.
First of all, why did you ask that question?
It was amazing to me that disconnect between what I was reading in the scientific literature about environmental threats to pregnancy, of which there's a whole body of knowledge and a whole big conversation in the scientific world. There's a disconnect between that and what I found myself reading as a pregnant woman who opened a lot of these popular guides to pregnancy, how to what to expect when you're expecting, and all of the other books that that are kind of cottage industry for women to enjoy their pregnancy. It almost seemed as though there were an unwritten rule that in the popular literature, you should speak no evil about the environment. You should be reassuring to the point of really, really being in denial that there are these problems. And my sense, and this is why I wrote Having Faith, is that pregnant women do want this information. The idea that we infantilize women who are pregnant and pat them on the head and say, just be happy, don't worry. I think those days are over, and women want this information, and they find it empowering. At least I did.
You are a scientist. You teach at Cornell University. And you're now a mother twice over. How has motherhood affected your thinking as a scientist? How has it changed the way you ask questions?
I think it doesn't Being a mother doesn't change the way I pose questions. I feel once I get into my scientist head, there's this very dispassionate, objective part of myself that, you know, can sit down and look at a whole bunch of data points on birth defects and not have an emotional response about that. And I'm just looking at the quality of the data. I'm being skeptical. I'm asking what happens if we graph this logarithmically. I'm asking, is the sample size large enough? But I think the way my motherhood plays a role is what happens when I'm ready. You know, I've got the data. I'm looking at some results, and now I want to draw some conclusions from it. And here's where I want to always err on the side of caution, more now even than before, so that if we have, for example, some evidence that some toxic chemical in the environment seems to be affecting children in this way, my scientist brain at some point turns off, and I no longer beat the drum, you know, as scientists do, asking for more research, saying, oh, this is very provocative, but we need more research. Suddenly my mother brain comes in here and says, you know what, I don't need any more proof or evidence that this is harmful to children. I have enough evidence now to ask, as a scientist, as a person, as a citizen who wants to influence policy, to ask that this chemical be divorced from our economy and keep our children out of harm's way. Let the research go on, but first I want to make sure that we're not using our children in this kind of unintended human experiment. So there's where motherhood and science, I think, comes together in the same way that I, you know, I'm teaching my 3-year-old daughter, Faith, now how to cross a street by looking both ways and by stopping every time. And, you know, you do this through incredible repetition. I don't need absolute proof that she's going to get hit by a car if I don't teach her these things. All I need is a remote possibility that she might be harmed, and I'm going to spend a lot of hours of my life working on this one task about stopping and looking both ways. And in a similar way, when I turn my scientist eye to looking at environmental toxicants, if we have an indication that these things are harming children, I want them out of our agricultural system, out of our industrial system, out of our playgrounds, out of our air, water, and food, pretty early on in the gathering of evidence process. This is called the precautionary principle.
How has pregnancy affected your thoughts and your actions as an environmentalist?
I think my pregnancy has made me realize something that I already knew, but it's really brought it home and made it real to me, which is that we are the environment, we are habitats, that it's not us versus the world. When we contaminate the world, we contaminate the insides of our own bodies, that the molecules of air, food, and water out there come inside of us. And, of course, for a normal non-reproductive person, these molecules rearrange themselves and become part of our tissues, our blood, our bones. We grow muscle, and we have blood plasma made from these things. But I think when you're growing a brand new human being inside of you and you realize that every molecule of this person, minus the very few molecules of genetic material that you contributed at conception, all of these things are coming together, are streaming in through you from the external environment. And so the communion between the inner physiological world of a human being and the outer ecological world is incredibly fascinating to me now in a way that I think I was dimly aware of before, but now I'm passionately aware of now.
You've written and talked extensively about the contamination of breast milk around the world, yet you choose to breastfeed your own children. What's the problem, and why is that?
Well, breast milk is as high as you can get on the human food chain, one rung higher than the food that we adults eat. And so for contaminants that concentrate as you move up the food chain, and I'm thinking of these chemicals called persistent organic pollutants, including dioxin, DDTs, PCBs, they reach their highest concentration in mother's milk. So mother's milk is truly, in some ways, the most contaminated human food on the planet. On the other hand, it is also the very best food for babies that there is. It's full of all kinds of living immune cells for my own my own bloodstream are flowing into my breast milk, providing immunity for my child. It's full of all kinds of agents that oversee the development of the brain. We know that kids who are breastfed perform better on cognitive tests, and they have better balance and coordination, better development. And so even though breast milk has been terribly compromised by the chemicals that I've spent years studying, it's apparent from other research that breastfed babies just do better. They're healthier, they're smarter, they're more coordinated than those who are fed breast milk's inferior pretender, i.e. infant formula. So yes, I breastfed my daughter Faith for more than 2 years and hope to breastfeed my son Elijah for at least that long. However, I'm also absolutely convinced that we need to get these chemicals out of the environment and get them out of women's breasts, because even though breast milk is still best, its ability to heal, its ability to prevent cancer, its ability to modulate the immune system is being compromised by the presence of cancer-causing chemicals, immune-suppressive chemicals, neurotoxins in breast milk.
I'm looking at the cover of your book. Tell me about the picture there.
Thereby hangs a tale. The picture is of me and my my daughter Faith. She's 2 years old, I think, in that picture. What the picture doesn't show, I think, is during the photo shoot, my 2-year-old was in a very bad mood and was in need of a nap and was very, very cranky. In fact, she had just ordered the photographer out of our house. And she's got this great smile on her face. That's because I'm, what you can't see outside the frame of the picture is that I'm tickling her, trying to evoke a smile. I myself am looking adoringly at her, but what I'm thinking in this picture is I hope I don't throw up, because I'm actually about 9 weeks pregnant with Elijah, my son, at this point when the photo shoot was taken. So somehow it all turned out. So what you see is this very loving look between mother and daughter.
What did you do differently in preparing for Elijah versus your daughter, Faith?
Well, I knew after having Faith that all of the medical contraptions and the medicalization of the birth itself, which I experienced with the hospital birth that I had with Faith. This is, of course, the subject of a couple of chapters of the book. I really didn't need that. And and all those trappings and all the, you know, everything down from the plastic bracelet, the IV drip, the gurneys, all these things that I've become so familiar with as a cancer patient and that were, I thought were going to be comforting to me when I gave birth, I realized I didn't want when I gave birth to my son Elijah. So I actually chose a very different birthplace, a place called the September Hill Birth Center in rural upstate New York. And I had a very joyous, unmedicalized birth in a bathtub there on the hottest day of the year, August 10th of this year. And I was assisted by midwives and a doula rather than a whole medical team. And it was a very different kind of birth.
Dr. Sandra Steingraber teaches biology at Cornell University and is author of the book Having Faith, An Ecologist's Journey to Motherhood. Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.